Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 409, titled Let's Make a Deal, Part 2, being recorded on May 11th of 2003. WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio, wfmu.org/Dave Emery, DaveEmory, has more recent For the Record programs streaming on Real Audio. Older programs available for download only on Real Audio at a longer URL linked to both the first wfmu.org/Dave Emery website and to the For the Record section of the Real Audio-equipped Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. Within a week or so of the airing of this program, there will be a detailed, annotated, article-length description of For the Record Program 409 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. Now, we're going to be taking a look at some more deals involving people connected with the Bush administration. In side one, we were talking about one of the business connections that links the Bush family with the Bin Laden family, and that is the Carlyle Group, a large private equity firm that had investments by the Bush family and also or the investments by the Bin Laden family, and that also involved both George's Bush. As we looked at in For the Record Program 347, the Carlyle Group was having its annual investor conference in Washington, D.C. on September 11, 2001, and firm head Frank Carlucci, former Elder Bush Secretary of State James Baker, and members of the Bin Laden family watched while the World Trade Center towers came down. On September 12th, members of the Bin Laden family were able to fly out of the United States. They were the only civilians who could fly in the U.S. on September 12th. We're going to take a look at the genesis of the Carlyle Group. The Carlyle Group originally grew out of a tax scam in which Native Eskimos were basically taken advantage of. And there is a book about the Carlyle Group just published by Dan Briody, B-R-I-O-D-Y. It's published by Wiley Publishers, W-I-L-E-Y. It's called The Iron Triangle. And it's about the Carlyle Group. There is a website that features an excerpt of the book. And again, look on the internet under the Iron Triangle. And this is a publishing group called Wiley. As the Carlyle Group began to gain steam, it benefited tremendously from the expertise of Fred Malek, a former personnel chief for Richard Nixon, and also someone who was working as a key campaign official for the elder George Bush's 1988 campaign. In a section called Counting the Jews, we read, "Then, in September of 1988, the Carlyle Group would get an infusion of experience and controversy when Frederick V. Malek, a former personnel chief for President Nixon, signed on. Malek, nicknamed the Axe for his days as Nixon's strongman, managed Norris and Doniello at Marriott in the early 1980s. These were two key people who also were key early Carlyle Group operatives. Continuing of Fred Malek, close friends with George H.W. Bush, Malek had just been rewarded for coordinating Bush's New Orleans convention with a position as deputy chairman of the Republican National Committee, or RNC, in August of 1988. What we're going to do now is to jump back to 1988, and specifically we're going to jump back to September 11th of 1988, when Miscellaneous Archive Show M24 was recorded, or the date on which Miscellaneous Archive Show M24 was recorded. This is available from Spitfire. It's called Nazis and Anti-Semites on the Bush Campaign. And after discussing the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization and its links with the P2 Lodge in Italy, with the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, with the Republican or with the Romanian Iron Guard veterans who jumped to the United States with the Galen Organization, and elements that I've spoken about in many broadcasts, we discuss Fred Malek. And in early September of 1988, a story broke that discussed Fred Malek Malek's role with Richard Nixon in attempting to blame the unemployment figures on the Jews, who, quote unquote, who were working for the Bureau of Labor and Statistics. I suspect that a similar anti-Semitic gambit is currently being disseminated within the so-called progressive sector, and particularly within the conspiracy community, talking about the Jews in Israel behind September 11th. It's a very similar sort of scapegoating and a bait and switch in which physical reality and economic reality are being ignored, and basically an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory is being disseminated. But in Miscellaneous Archive Show M24, recorded on September 11th, 1988, after discussing the Nazis and anti-Semites who jumped to the Nixon campaign and to the Bush campaign, courtesy of the Republican Ethnics, something we've spoken about in the past, the following article was presented discussing Fred Malek. This is from Miscellaneous Archive Show M24, recorded on September 11th, 1988. In addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of my very charming and capable former co-host, Nip Tuck, who assisted me with the on-air responsibilities. Now, bear in mind Richard Nixon's free association with these Nazis and anti-Semites. As you read, as you listen to the following article, this from the front page of the San Jose Mercury for this morning, September 11th of 1988. A Washington Post story by Walter Pincus and Bob Woodward. It's Dateline Washington headline, GOP aide got data on Jews for Nixon. Subheaded, Bush appointee denies ousting officials in 71. Frederick Malek, chosen recently by George Bush as a key GOP campaign official, compiled figures in 1971 on the number of Jewish officials in the Bureau of Labor Statistics at then President Nixon's request. According to notes taken by White House aides, Nixon had ordered Malek to investigate, quote, a Jewish cabal at the agency. At the time, Malek was Nixon's White House personnel chief and had been assigned to evaluate the BLS staff. On July 27th of 1971, Malek reported to H.R. Haldeman, Nixon's chief of staff, that 13 of 35 top BLS officials were Jewish, according to a memo found last week in the archives from Nixon's presidency. Less than 2 months after Malek's memo, two senior BLS officials who are Jewish were ousted from their posts and moved to less visible positions in the Labor Department agency. They were Peter Henley, H-E-N-L-E, chief economist for BLS, and Harold Goldstein, the director of current employment analysis. Records in the Nixon archives show that 134 documents have been withdrawn from Malek's White House files by Nixon's lawyers, who asserted that their release could involve invasion of privacy or violation of other rights. So an extremely ironic statement in light of the investigation of Jews and subsequent the number of Jews in the Bureau of Labor Statistics and subsequent removal by two of them. Note that Malek apparently held a position analogous. In fact, it might be the exact same position that Helena von Dahn had in charge of personnel for the White House, worth bearing in mind here. Continuing with the article, dozens of other documents filed in the Nixon archives authored by Malek or directed to him also have been withdrawn by Nixon's lawyers. One knowledgeable source said Nixon's representatives carefully went through the files of former Nixon aides who have played or are playing roles in the Bush campaign. Bush picked Malek to manage the Republican National Convention in August and later selected him as deputy chairman of the Republican National Committee with day-to-day responsibility for the party's fall campaign. Malek said Friday that he recalled the incident and had gathered the statistics, quote, but in no way did I take part in moving anyone out of the BLS, unquote. Allegations of anti-Semitism became an issue for the Bush campaign last week after a Jewish newspaper charged that several members of a Bush advisory committee on ethnic issues had passed affiliations that appeared anti-Jewish. Interrupting here, notice the watering down in the language there. A Jewish newspaper charged that several members of a Bush advisory committee on ethnic issues had passed affiliations that appeared anti-Jewish. These guys were bloody fascists who had participated in the Final Solution, among other things, as documented in the current book, Blowback. But I guess
there is a certain appearance of anti-Semitism to that, I suppose.
Yeah, I suppose slaughtering millions of Jews is certainly that has the appearance of anti-Semitism.
But it is interesting that now it's the statement is portrayed as a charge by a Jewish newspaper, which subtly makes it sound as though this was some sort of, you know, Zionist vendetta or something, instead of simply a matter of recorded historical fact.
That again from Miscellaneous Archive Show M24, recorded on September 11th, 1988, 13 years to the day before September 11th and 13 years to the day before the Carlyle Group's annual investor conference was being held in Washington, D.C. Now, after Fred Malek had to basically resign from the Republican Party and from the Bush administration, the first George H.W. Bush administration, he basically went from his position as deputy chairman of the Republican National Committee, in which he oversaw the incorporation of some of the same Iron Guard, anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, Nazi and Third Reich veterans that had been incorporated into the Republican ethnic organization in the wake of World War II, and that were still present when the elder George Bush was running for the first time. And he went straight from the Republican National Committee deputy chairmanship to a key position with Carlyle. And although he was only with the growing Carlyle Group for a short period of time, it was his position that made many of the Carlyle Group's key connections, which helped to foster its remarkable growth. Speaking of Malek's resignation in the wake of the BLS scandal, we turn to The Iron Triangle by Dan Briody. He, Malek, knew that he was in political danger, and he knew immediately where to go. Norris called Malek the day the news hit the papers and told him to calm down and come over to the Carlyle offices on Pennsylvania Avenue. Malek had his motorcade sneak into the garage so as not to be seen by anyone. "I've never seen a man so upset in my life," Norris recalls. "He was literally shaking," unquote. Norris set Malek up with an office adjoining his own, and Carlyle gave him a draw or a salary, which Malek would theoretically have to earn back. Malek was by far the best connected of the nascent company. He brought with him deep relationships with the Bush family, the Saudi Arabian royal family, and countless Washington insiders. Even with his freshly tainted reputation, he would go on to spearhead several big deals for the company, including an ill-fated buyout of Cater Air, the Texas-based airline catering company that would hire George W. Bush. Though Malek's stay at Carlyle would amount to nothing more than time on the lam, hiding out while the furor over his anti-Semitic actions died down, he did manage to set Carlyle up with a handful of high-powered Republican connections. He would soon return to public life to lead President George H.W. Bush's re-election campaign in 1991, skipping down. Though brief, Malek's time with Carlyle would ultimately change the face of the company forever. Quote, "I brought a little more name recognition, a little more gray hair," unquote, recalled Malek in an interview for this book. So it's interesting that Fred Malek, the guy who purged the BLS of, quote, Jews, unquote, under Richard Nixon, and also the key guy who, after he presided over the incorporation of some of these fascist and Central Eastern European ethnics into the George H.W. Bush first campaign, Malek was forced to resign but went straight to the Carlyle Group and later was back on board with the Republican Party in 1991. What we're going to look at next is part of a deal involving the sale of the Silicon Valley Group and its Tinsley Laboratory subsidiary to a Dutch holding company, ASM Lithography. Now, in For the Record 311, and I'm not going to go into this in detail, we detailed key Bush aide Karl Rove's role in this particular negotiation. Specifically, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal of June 14th of 2001 on page A4. Rove's intel meeting didn't affect ruling, White House says, and this involves Karl Rove's meeting with Intel. Karl Rove held stock in Intel and consequently was in a position to benefit from the sale of Silicon Valley Group to ASM Lithography. And the significance of this deal, which apparently was brokered to a certain extent by Karl Rove, was that it was opposed by the Pentagon and that it involved the sale of key technology to a Dutch company in turn linked to German cartels that have done business with companies that have been enemies of the United States. The following is excerpted from For the Record program number 272 from January of 2001. We're going to move now to the San Jose Mercury News of Tuesday, January 9th of the year 2001. This is an op-ed column by Alan Tonelson, T-O-N-E-L-S-O-N. He is described here as a research fellow with the U.S. Business and Industry Council Education Foundation, a business-affiliated research book, a research group, excuse me. This column is titled by the San Jose Mercury News, Spy Tech, the U.S. Edge, and it reads in part as follows. When Dick Cheney and Colin Powell are overseeing U.S. military operations during the Persian Gulf War in 1990 and 91, much of their intelligence data on Saddam Hussein's forces were the result of technology that came from Tinsley Laboratories of Richmond, California. Tinsley, T-I-N-S-L-E-Y, has been the sole manufacturer of many of the state-of-the-art mirrors and lenses in the high-powered cameras carried by America's spy satellite systems that the Clinton administration has called, quote, among the most valuable U.S. national security assets, unquote. The U.S. government has long sought to restrict foreign access to this technology, but that's about to change. As Cheney, Powell, and the rest of the Bush team prepare to take office, Tinsley's parent company, Silicon Valley Group Incorporated, is scheduled to pass into foreign hands. Note that the parent company is Silicon Valley Group. We're going to focus on that company and its history in a minute. Resuming with the last sentence, as Cheney, Powell, and the rest of the Bush team prepare to take office, Tinsley's parent company, Silicon Valley Group Incorporated, is scheduled to pass into foreign hands. Unless the Clinton administration acts by Friday, its legal authority to hold up the proposed sale will expire, and the U.S. manufacturer will become part of a Dutch company, ASM Lithography. Since ASM announced the acquisition of SVG Tinsley in October, President Clinton's leading national security advisors have not shown much interest in closely reviewing the deal. Some career government officials are saying privately that their superiors do not seem adequately focused on determining whether foreign ownership of SVG Tinsley will damage U.S. national security interests. Last week, the issue got the attention of Senator Robert F. Bennett, Republican of Utah. He asked Treasury Secretary Lawrence H. Summers, whose department heads an interagency committee charged with evaluating the impact of such takeovers on national security, to authorize a full investigation of the acquisition. Ordering such an investigation would have the effect of delaying the sale for at least 45 days, enough time for the new administration to block the deal. It will also give President-elect Bush a chance to show that he is serious about rebuilding the U.S. military and maintaining control over its high-tech foundations. Skipping down, SVG is going to be purchased by ASM Lithography. They are based in the Netherlands. And the column continues, skipping down, although the Netherlands plainly deserves its reputation as a loyal NATO ally, some U.S. defense and intelligence officials worry that ASM's far-flung global operations and corporate alliances with companies like Germany's Carl Zeiss, capital Z-E-I-S-S, and Schott Glass, capital S-C-H-O-T-T, could make it more difficult to keep SVG Tinsley's advanced optics and lithography capabilities from migrating to unfriendly countries. And we're going to take a look at a couple of past examples of the Zeiss and Schott firms and their operations against the United States in wartime in just a minute. Skipping down in the column, SVG Tinsley's technologies are found throughout the U.S. military's highest tech systems and are crucial to the Pentagon's future plans. In addition to strengthening the U.S. reconnaissance network, the company's optics are used in the lasers in missile defense systems being developed by the U.S. government's nuclear weapons labs at Livermore, California, and Sandia, New Mexico. Note that this is the same area where both Ben Eastland, probably Bernard Eastland, and also the aforementioned Sandia laboratories discussed in that Tornado article, that's the same area where these particular elements crop up, among others. read the last sentence again. In addition to strengthening the U.S. reconnaissance network, the company's optics are used in the lasers in missile defense systems being developed by the U.S. government's nuclear weapons lab at Livermore, California, and Sandia, New Mexico. What we're going to do now is to take a look at the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. That's the story of the remarkable and deadly Bormann Flight Capital Organization, literally the economic component of a Third Reich gone underground. This book was authored by Paul Manning, a member of the CBS News team that covered the war in Europe, along with Edward R. Murrow. Manning trained as a gunner on a B-17 in order to cover the raids into Western Europe, shot down an ME-109, broadcast the surrender of Germany on the CBS radio network, then flew missions as a member of a crew of a B-29 into Japan, and broadcast the surrender of Japan on the CBS radio network as well, then used his connections with Alan Dulles, among other things, to investigate the remarkable and deadly Bormann Flight Capital Organization, the political and economic component of a Third Reich gone underground. I realize that that will appear crazy to uninitiated listeners. I've done numerous broadcasts about that in the past that are available from Spitfire and that will flesh out listeners' understanding. Turning to Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, and the Dr. Scheid here is SS Lieutenant General Dr. Scheid. He also cited the Zeiss Company, the Leica Company, and the Hamburg America Line as typical firms that had been especially effective in protecting German interests abroad. He gave New York addresses to the 12 men. Now, again, note that Karl Rove, an individual that I believe is the point man for the Underground Reich in this administration, was instrumental in helping to broker the sale of ASM Lithography, of Silicon Valley Group to ASM Lithography with its Tinsley Laboratories. Note that, as we talked about in For the Record 272, one of the founders of Silicon Valley Group is a chief funder of the Aryan Nations. More about Karl Rove and his role as the Svengali of the Bush White House and his relationship with Grover Norquist. This from the New York Times of April 5th, 2003. An article, Pushing an Agenda Far from Iraq, by Adam Nagorny and Richard W. Stevenson. Skipping down, speaking of Karl Rove, even so, his friends say they assume he addresses these questions during extensive private time with Mr. Bush. They go the other way and keep Karl out of the room where, absent the critique, you'd want Karl in the room, unquote, said Grover Norquist, president of Americans for Tax Reform, a conservative group that works closely with Mr. Rove. Well, Grover Norquist not only works with Mr. Rove, he's the point man for cutting taxes for this administration, thereby placing the U.S. in serious economic trouble. He also was the point man for the Islamists and the Al-Taqwa, Al-Qaeda, Hamas connections to the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization, for which Fred Malek had worked under the first Bush administration. We've talked about that in numerous broadcasts, FTR 357, FTR 400, and FTR 407 among them. The following article deals with some of the background of Karl Rove, and like Malek, he goes back to the Nixon administration in terms of his political genesis. This is from the newsletter Counterpunch, and this article is Exposing Karl Rove by Wayne Madsen. It's from Counterpunch's issue of November 1st of 2002 of Karl Rove. He's America's Joseph Goebbels. As a 21-year-old young Republican in Texas, Karl Rove not only pimped for Richard Nixon's chief political dirty trick strategist, Donald Segretti, but soon caught the eye of the incoming Republican National Committee chairman, George H.W. Bush. Rove's dirty tricks on behalf of Nixon's 1972 campaign catapulted Rove onto the national stage. From his eagle's nest in the West Wing of the White House, Rove now directs a formidable political dirty tricks operation and disinformation mill. Since his formative political years, when he tried to paint World War II B-24 pilot and hero George McGovern as a left-wing peacenik through his mid-level career as a planter of disinformation in the media on behalf of Texas and national GOP candidates, to his current role as W's Svengali, Rove has practiced the same style of slash-and-burn politics as did his Nixonian mentor, Segretti. So note that Karl Rove was a protege of Donald Segretti, who was part of the dirty tricks milieu under Richard Nixon. He actually was stationed at Fort Ord. Skipping down in this article, German opposition figures in the mid-1930s often lamented the fact that he could have stopped the rise of the Nazis if only they had been more united in a common front when they had a chance. However, they fell prey to the media manipulation of Goebbels and fought among themselves more than they did against the menace from the far right. We Americans also have an early opportunity to stem an out-of-control, an anti-constitutional regime with a Rasputin-like rove at the after-steerage helm of our ship of state. This was written just before Election Day. And by the way, Wayne Madsen wrote the introduction to the book Forbidden Truth, which details John O'Neill's attempted exposure of the Saudi links to American oil companies and to the Bush family. Last but not least, in terms of tracing some of the people who are dirty tricksters with the Republican Party, a woman named Lucy Goldberg, or Lucianne Goldberg, who also, by the way, was the literary agent for Mark Furman. Mark Furman's white supremacist connections were one of the interesting things that was suppressed in the O.J. Simpson investigation, as well as the fact that in a report from three assistant deputy DAs to Marsha Clark, the fact that Mark Furman was expressing romantic interest in Nicole Brown Simpson was one of the, among the things that got ignored in the O.J. Simpson investigation. But the Furman literary agent Lucianne Goldberg was also the person who prodded Linda Tripp, a Bush White House appointee who'd done classified work on under the anti-terrorism rubric. It was Lucy Goldberg who convinced Linda Tripp to tape Monica Lewinsky, and that basically led to the impeachment proceedings against Bill Clinton. For people that bought on to a lot of the anti-Clinton mythology, there's a very good book called Blinded by the Right, subtitled The Conscience of an Ex-Conservative, authored by David Brock, who helped to break the Troopergate's stories. This was published in softcover by Three Rivers Press of New York. And the ISBN number is 1-4000-4728-5. And of Lucy Goldberg's background, we read, "The deal died, but Goldberg stayed on the case, ultimately getting the news about Lewinsky to the Jones camp, setting in motion the perjury trap. Goldberg, who referred to herself as an agent provocateur, was once a paid undercover operative for Richard Nixon, infiltrating the 1972 presidential campaign of George McGovern. Anthony Lucas, author of Nightmare, The Underside of the Nixon Years, quoted Goldberg as saying, quote, "They were looking for really dirty stuff, who was sleeping with whom, what the Secret Service men were doing with the stewardesses, who was smoking pot on the plane, that sort of thing," unquote. According to the New Yorker, Goldberg had harbored a hatred for Democrats since Nixon's forced resignation, but she was also in it for fun and profit. Apparently making deals. So as well as Karl Rove and Fred Malek, Lucy Goldberg, also with a pedigree that runs back to the dirty tricksters under Richard Nixon. This, before we wrap up this broadcast, the For the Record program is being archived on Real Audio by WFMU, wfmu.org/Dave Emery, with more recent programs streaming on Real Audio. Older programs available for download only on Real Audio at a longer URL linked to both the Spitfire the For the Record section of the Spitfire website and to the wfmu.org/Dave Emery website. Spitfire website, spitfirelist.com. Spitfire sends the For the Record programs for free to stations that wish to air them, and I do not get money from any of the arrangements with Spitfire. They have all of the programs available in lengthy descriptions. Do visit the Spitfire website. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 409, Let's Make a Deal Part 2, being recorded on May 11th of 2003. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.